This is Polly Young Eisendrath. This is March 10th, 2000. What Women Really Want. Tape 1 of 4.
Last year, and it's a wonderful place, and I understand she actually is an unofficial ambassador for Vermont. She has a private practice there and is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont Medical College. Polly is a practicing Buddhist, and her writing integrates Buddhism, Jung psychology, and feminism. I experience Polly as a dynamic presenter who is extremely enthusiastic about her subject and very thorough in her research. She is able to present rather complex concepts in a very human and understandable way. Her dedication is reflected in her writing and in her lectures, and I feel it's an honor for us to have her here this evening for her to be presenting to us on her latest book, Women and Desire. Please join me in welcoming Polly Young Eisendrath.
Thank you very much. There's one there. The whole thing, you can take the sheet and go home. And then you'll know what I was saying. It also gives you the possibility of listening to me without taking notes or recording. But if you want to take notes and record, feel free to do that also. I mean, there's no problem with however you want to listen to me, but this just gives you something to take with you. I'm going to be talking primarily about five topics tonight, and I'm going to go over those topics briefly before I start. I will be reading bits and pieces of my presentation, but as much as possible, I will talk with you. I'm also going to tell a couple of stories and show some clips from some movies. So it's a multimedia presentation. So before I begin, I just want to say a couple of things that so that you're perfectly clear about this. I am a Jungian analyst. And I'm a psychologist. I'm a developmental psychologist by training. I practice now as a clinical psychologist. So I'm touching base on that because you may not believe it by the end, that a lot of times people come up to me afterwards and say, are you really a Jungian analyst? But I am, and tomorrow when I will be talking about couple relationships, I will talk somewhat about my own approach to complex and archetype and those things, which is very much in line with a particular Jungian school. But tonight, I'll be talking about certain kinds of topics in a more general way, but always with the background of Jung's psychology. So first, not only Jung's psychology, but Jung's psychology among others. So first, I'm going to say a few words about desire. And you may have noticed that desire is different from love. This may have already come to your notice, that we can desire things that we know nothing about. It's a very ordinary thing. People observe this in themselves all the time. They can desire, for example, erotically desire a stranger. And they can desire things that aren't a bit good for them, and also things that they know won't turn out well in the end. And it would be very difficult to love something that you knew wouldn't turn out well in the end. So desire and love are different, and I want to start with that because to have a little background on what desire is will help us along the way tonight. And I take my ideas about desire both from psychoanalysis and Buddhism. Desire actually is a state of absence or lack. When you desire something, it's not present. When you have it, you tend not to desire it. And again, you may have noticed this, that the new car, the new lover, even the baby that you wanted so much, when you actually have it, isn't what you expected it would be and doesn't really seem to meet the desire that you had. Desire is really only present in the absence of the thing that promises pleasure. And so it is itself this peculiar state that the Buddhists noticed, and that the psychoanalyst notices that exists on the basis of absence, of lack. Now, love, on the other hand, has something to do with knowledge. That is, in order to love something, you have to know it. In fact, I would say, in order to know something, you have to love it. Love actually is, as the poet Octavio Paz says, the place or the situation or the event in which desire meets reality. When you love something or someone, you actually learn that your desires aren't going to be fulfilled, that that being or that thing is no longer a function of your projection. And you then, in loving it, have to come to embrace it, to know it, to care about it or that person, in the absence of being able to control it. So to love something really means to know it, and in order to know something or someone, it has to be revealed. So we could say that in order for us to be loved, we have to reveal ourselves. And we have to reveal ourselves in some way that is authentically true to ourselves, or we can't actually be loved. So we have to be known in order to be loved. And I'm saying this as a background to what I'm going to talk about tonight, because I'm going to talk about the problem of presenting yourself as an object of desire and how being an object of desire, you can never really be loved because you cannot be known. And many times, women in particular do not understand this. Now, everything that I'm going to say tonight applies to both women and men. And all that I say about being an object of desire could apply to a man as well. And I've seen many men in therapy who also want primarily to be objects of desire. But there's a particular situation that occurs in relation to women that creates a kind of double bind around the problem of being an object of desire that doesn't occur for men. And Simone de Beauvoir saw this when she wrote The Second Sex. The book that I've just written or am here to talk from, or however you want to say it, the book Women and Desire, I consider to be a continuation of The Second Sex. Simone de Beauvoir said in The Second Sex that when men set themselves up to be the subjects of their own desires, when they became the agents of their own lives, that they had to find an object that would be equal in power but under their control. And they chose the beautiful woman to be the object of desire. Now, so men can be objects of desire and women can be objects of desire. And in both cases, the power that that individual has is not under his or her control. It's under the control of the subject. Now, when it comes to having power for women, there really are only two approaches to female power, and I'll be talking about this in various ways tonight. One is the indirect approach of the object of desire, that is to attract attention or involvement or to be seen as vital and full of inspiration and so on as the object of desire, and you have a certain power. And the other one is the direct approach to power, which is to take a direct approach to making your own decisions, to being self-determining, and to speaking directly about what you want. To take that route for a woman means to go through the land of the bitch. Because women cannot have direct sort of connection to their own desires and their own powers without being seen in some way as being negative, negatively powerful. And I'll be talking a lot about this tonight, about the bitch, the hag, the nag, this particular character who has existed in patriarchal culture since the beginning. And she's a picture of the negatively powerful female. And this sort of, I will call her primarily the bitch, although we could call her the nag or the hag. And I will be telling a story about her that comes from the Middle Ages, But we could say that this figure, the negatively powerful female, is an image of the kind of devaluation of female power. And all women in this period of time, as opportunities have been opened through feminism, as doors have been opened for us to step in and take opportunities, all of us have to walk through the land of the bitch in order to get to a place of self-determination. And this is something that is very frequently not talked about. And even as feminism has had a very big effect on not only our culture, but many cultures, and now really all over the world, and many more opportunities are open for women, very few people have talked directly about the problems of female self-determination and how those problems create a kind of double bind for girls and women, that they are promised power through being the object of desire. And if they claim their power directly, they're going to be seen in a negative light. This creates a double bind, and what happens typically, and we see it here in this country a great deal, is that the young girl, if she can, is going to try to be the object of desire, even in an environment where she's free to be a subject of her own desire. And so we have at this period of time probably the greatest problems ever with eating disorders and young women being preoccupied with the body image and identifying themselves with an image and a way of appearing rather than with the freedom to determine their own lives. So that's sort of part of what I'm going to talk about tonight, a kind of overview. I want to say a couple more words about background, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about autonomy and shame and doubt and how autonomy is developed. When I decided to write this book, I was influenced by a number of things. One, I wanted to write about desire because I had, from my experiences with doing clinical work and as an analyst and as a Buddhist, been very interested in desire and how it creates distortion, whether one is desiring a lot of money, a new home, a new baby, a new lover, or enlightenment. That desire creates various kinds of problems. So I proposed to my agent that I write a book about desire, and she said, could never sell that. You have to write a book about women and desire. And she convinced me in part because as we talked, I realized that a lot of my questions about desire had come up in working with women in psychotherapy, both in individual therapy and analysis and in couples therapy. And one of the things that I came up against very often would be a situation in doing therapy where I'd be face-to-face with a woman and I would say, well, what do you want? What do you want here? And the woman would not be able to answer me. She would either say something like, well, what do you think? Or she would say, well, you know, in terms of what so-and-so needs, or I think I should do it this way, she would not answer, I want such and such. So that was an interesting situation to find that many, many women, in my experience, would be indirect in saying what they wanted. Secondly, after I published Female Authority, which is a book I did with Florence Wiedemann, it came out in 1987, I had lots of women come to see me about issues having to do with competence, authority, and decision-making in the workplace particularly, and I would get invited to do talks on gender differences in the workplace and all sorts of interesting things in regard to the use of female power in the workplace. And so consequently, I would see lots of women in therapy who were very successful in their work, presidents of corporations, a dean of a college, a successful writer, successful artist. And typically, these women who were well-respected in their line of work would feel out of control in their personal lives, always overwhelmed, feeling like they had taken on responsibilities or duties or arrangements that they hadn't intended to take on. And often they were resentful about what they were doing at home. So again, that was a curious situation because here were women who were making important decisions in their work lives and can't seem to make decisions at home. So, you know, who's driving the car then? What's going on at home? So that was another situation that interested me. And then the third one was that I was reading a lot of Lacan, as a French psychoanalyst, Jacques Lacan, whose work is almost impenetrable. And he's a terrible womanizer. He was a terrible womanizer and also analyzed a lot of women. But he said very intriguing things to say. I found it difficult to... he talks a lot about desire and about being the object of desire. And I found it difficult sometimes to cope with how much I found him believable in regard to women, even though I found also I disagreed with him profoundly. And one of the things he said is that whatever it is that women want, it is not love, because they give their love to men who want them, not to men who love them. And reading that, my first response was, of course that's not true. Women want to be loved. I'm with them all the time, and of course they want to be loved. And then I thought a little more, and I realized that there was something that had the ring of truth about what he was saying, but it wasn't really so directly in what he was saying about women, but more in relation to the condition that women are in. And out of this idea in Lacan, I gradually came to recognize what I told you earlier of the difference between love and desire, and how women very often will unknowingly present themselves as objects of desire, as desiring to be desired, as wanting to be approved, as wanting to be wanted, and not know that they cannot be loved under those circumstances because they haven't revealed themselves. So Lacan was another reason why I decided to write this book. So that's a little bit of background. And, of course, the subtitle of the book is Beyond Wanting to be Wanted. And so tonight I'm going to spend the first part of this presentation talking about what it means to want to be wanted and how one loses the sense of being what would be called in psychoanalysis a subject, that is, the agent of one's own life. The decision maker and the driver of one's own car, so to speak, how one loses that in wanting to be wanted, and whether one is doing that as a mother, as a wife, as a lover, as a worker, as a neighbor, or in a spiritual setting where one tries to give oneself away, that there is a real problem in wanting to be wanted. So first I'll talk about that, and then I'm going to talk about the solution to it. But often when people see the problem, the solution is actually pretty easy to come to. So I will spend quite a long time on the problem and the different levels of it and trying to give you a kind of nuanced sense of this as a problem, because many times I find that people believe that that the doors are all open to women and girls, and that that task is finished. When in fact, those of us who work with the problems that women and girls face all over the world, but particularly here in our society, where we find young women so sort of absorbed with their appearances, realize that the work has only begun, and that we've only taken a very small step. So let me talk a little bit about, then, self-determination, about this notion of autonomy. Now, autonomy is a word that many women seem to confuse with selfishness and self-centeredness. Autonomy literally means being able to make decisions for yourself. And making decisions for yourself does not mean that you're selfish. Actually, you can make the decision to care for others, but if you make that decision fully yourself, you will not resent the situation you're in. And very often people will ask me, how do I know whether I am being self-determining? And I say, keep a little resentment meter. And if you feel you're doing something resentfully, you haven't actually made the decision. Because when you decide to do what you're doing, and you become self-determining, whether you're giving yourself away in caring for others because you've decided to do that, as, say, Mother Teresa decided, or whether you're sitting zazen for hours and hours immobile somewhere on a retreat, or whether you are, you know, taking out the garbage or sorting the recycling, whatever it is, if you decided to do it, you know that you're there because you decided and you're not resentful. And so that's really a key to the issue of self-determination, is that you're doing it with an open heart because you decided to do it. That doesn't mean you don't get tired or that you're not afraid or that you're not hesitant or you're not angry or other things, but resentful you're not, because you can check in with yourself, I really wanted to do this. So autonomy means the ability to make decisions for yourself. And in order to develop autonomy, you have to, over time, growing up, learn the skills of becoming an autonomous person. And in terms of parents helping their children become autonomous, first, generally, we discipline our children, we provide guidelines, then we serve as an example, and we guide them in some more, you might say, sort of open way, so that they can fail in their decision-making while they're still at home. They can sometimes make poor decisions when they're still under the protection of home, so that they learn the difference between making a thoughtful, good decision and one that's done poorly. So if children are growing up with the ability to develop autonomy, they are learning in various ways the importance of being self-determining over a long period of time. Another way to say it, we teach them how to become responsible for themselves so that they are accountable for the decisions that they make. Now, there are problems in the teaching of girls and women in how to become autonomous. I won't be able to go into those in great depth tonight, but we could say that from birth onwards, and maybe even before birth, now that we have all the ultrasound tests and so on, girls are encouraged to be pretty popular and nice. And often, pretty popular and nice interferes with self-determination. And just in the way that I was saying earlier, there can be a double bind set up for a girl so that she cannot feel that she can make the choices for herself, because she won't be seen as nice if she does, or she won't be popular, or whatever. So we very often don't help our daughters really develop self-determination, because we as mothers and as teachers and as mentors will encourage this sort of appearance or image of being desired and desirable. Now, this doesn't mean, as I will return later to this issue, this doesn't mean that self-determining women or self-determining girls can't be pretty popular and nice. It doesn't mean that at all. That's always an option. But it means that those things aren't the focus of the child's development. Those aren't the things that are focused on and aren't the things that are offered as the major way of entering into society. Now, what happens with girls, and again, I can cite studies on this or tell you examples from developmental psychology, is that girls are often shamed when they do things that aren't nice. And to be shamed means in some way to be interpreted as being wrong or bad in yourself, not doing the wrong thing, but being a bad person. So Erik Erikson, the psychoanalyst, early on in the 1950s, saw that shame and doubt were in opposition to autonomy. His second stage of development is the conflict around autonomy versus shame and doubt. And he saw this as a conflict that develops in the second year of life, and then if it's not pretty well resolved. It continues to develop, and it, even if it is resolved, it still develops in different forms over the lifespan, this conflict between autonomy and shame and doubt. And so I want to say something about shame, because shame enters into the issues that have to do with this double bind that I talked about earlier. Shame is a self-conscious emotion. It's one of what are called the secondary emotions. All human infants are born, if they're normal infants, are born with the primary emotions, and you can count them as 5 or 6 or 7, depending on how you count them. And animals also, the higher animals, domestic animals and so on, show evidence of having these same emotions. Emotions like sadness and joy and disgust. Now, those emotions that infants are born with are there from birth and have an organizing function. They organize the young being towards various relational situations with other beings. Around 18 months, you start to see the development of what are called the secondary emotions. And these are the emotions that indicate that the self now feels separate from the other. Or what you might say, that the infant now feels contained as, I am in here, and that is out there, contained in this bag of skin that we call the body. There is a sense of the individual subject, the I-ness, the me-ness, the terrible twos, me, comes into being around 18 months with these emotions. And the emotions are, you know, like shame, embarrassment, jealousy, envy, pride, self-pity, these and guilt. These are the emotions that organize us towards the experience of self and other. Now, I'm very fascinated with these emotions, but I won't go on about them. But just, I want to spend a few minutes with shame. Shame is the experience that the self is bad. There's something bad or inferior about the self. When someone feels ashamed, what they will do is try to hide, deceive, cover up, or in the extreme, they will kill themselves. They will disappear. They'll try to take themselves out of the game, because you can't do anything to change your situation if you think you're fundamentally inferior or bad. All you can do is to try to cover that up. Do you see what I'm talking about? A guilt is the experience of doing something wrong. When you're guilty about your actions, you can repair that by repairing and changing your actions. So guilt actually can bring a kind of positive motivation of reparation. But shame does not have such a positive motivation associated with it. So we find many, many therapists, psychologists, social workers, and so on are very interested in shame these days. What is what's called a shame-based environment, where people are shamed instead of feeling guilty, then they learn to deceive and cover up and hide themselves rather than actually to change their actions. If you shame a child, the child will feel bad about itself and not feel that it can change its actions. So girls actually in growing up in both the home and the school environments are shamed more than boys are. And they are made to feel in some way ashamed at being female, particularly if they're aggressive in their actions or if they act in ways that are not nice. Now, this experience of shame, as I said, also fits with the notion of covering yourself up, of assuming an image or a persona or a way of being that covers up who you really are. Consequently, then, when girls are offered the opportunity to take on an image and to be desirable through that image, it fits on a number of levels for them. When you feel a lot of shame, you begin to doubt that you know anything. And you begin to doubt especially that you know what you know. You begin to doubt your experience. And I would tell you a little story about that experience, and then I'll show a little film clip from the movie that I'll be showing clips from, which is Living Out Loud, with Holly Hunter and Danny DeVito and Queen Latifah. I usually say Latifah, and people have told me it's Latifah. So it's Queen Latifah. But I'm going to tell you a little story that Jack Kornfield tells on one of his Buddhist tapes, one of his Roots of Buddhist Psychology tapes. And it illustrates the experience of shame and doubt, the effect that it has. A little boy, an 8-year-old boy, is out to dinner with his parents. And the waitress comes over to the table, the parents order, and then the waitress says to the little boy, "Well, what will you have?" He says, "I'll have a hot dog, French fries, a Coke." His mother says, no. He'll have milk, meatloaf, and peas. And so the waitress looks at the little boy and she says, "Ketchup on the fries?" And he says, "Yes, please." And she leaves. And so he turns to his parents and he says, "She thinks I'm real." So when your experience is regularly undermined, you don't think you're real. You don't think that you know your own experience. And girls and women very often enter into situations, and many of us who developed as children and adolescents and even in my college years were in educational situations where our experiences were undermined regularly. We know now from the studies that the AAUW did of girls and boys in elementary, secondary, and college situations, that teachers tend to validate boys' experiences much more than they validate girls'. I know when I was in college, I would be amazed how often I thought in a class that I had given an answer that suited the professor's question, but a boy then would give, seem to me, the same answer, and he would be the person that the professor would refer to as giving the right answer. This way of perceiving girls and boys is something that was so universal, and even now is hard to change for teachers, that teachers in many ways approach girls from the point of view that they should never be aggressive, that they're rarely right in what they say, and that they really wouldn't probably know the right answers. Now, some of this has changed, but still it's very often the case, let's say, in educational settings, that there is some greater tendency to believe boys or men than to believe girls and women. So that's one kind of situation in which the girl or the woman basically is like the little boy in the story. She doesn't think she's real. The other kind of situation that comes up very often is the kind of situation where the woman is having some sort of perception. Particularly, you might say, in a relational situation, she's having a perception of what's going on. She's talking to, let's say, her male partner, who doesn't in any way validate her perception, not even to the degree of saying, "I can see what you mean," not necessarily in affirming it or agreeing with it, but not even saying that. So the woman says something like, I sense that you're not listening closely to what I'm saying. And the man says, "I don't know what you're talking about." And so then the woman tries to illustrate it, and he says, it doesn't make any sense to me. Rather than in some way joining into her experience, even to say, "I disagree with it," simply invalidates it. So what we find, particularly when women are in some kind of shame-based environment, is that their experience gets undermined. And what I'm going to show in this film clip is a situation that I hear a lot about over time in therapy. And this situation could be gender-reversed, but here we have a woman who believes her husband is having an affair. And she is trying to tell him or ask him questions to see if she has perceived this accurately. And the way that he responds to her, now, in this particular clip, she's not internalizing it. She's not sort of taking it on. But the way he responds to her is that she's crazy, that this doesn't make any sense at all. All of you probably remember the term gaslighting, which has to do with a film called Gaslights, in which Ingrid Bergman was undermined in her experience by her husband, who actually was turning down the lights in the house and then telling her that there wasn't actually any change. So it is this experience of being gaslighted that will often happen to shame a woman's experience, and then she begins to doubt it, and then she ends up actually being thwarted in her autonomy and uncertain about what she knows. So I'm going to play this clip and then return to talking about wanting to be wanted. In this film, Holly Hunter is... This actually is, if you saw the movie, this clip takes place before the titles come on. So it's the very first thing you see in the movie. And she's a woman who is married to a physician, and you'll find out a little bit later, for almost 20 years. And he's regularly had affairs. Here she's confronting him. She knows this also. Here she's confronting him with her observation about some recent information that she's gotten. And he is responding to her. Now, keep it in mind that this is a comedy, and it's fine to laugh, because sometimes everybody gets so serious. So Holly Hunter, and I don't know the name of the actor who plays her husband.
Say a goddamn word. We get into the restaurant and out of nowhere.
So what are you saying? You were with this woman?
Yes, I was. I was having lunch. So what?
But Teddy didn't see you with your arm around her?
Doctor, they made Judith the rest.
Teddy said he saw you with your arm around her. He said you were just about to leave when he spotted you.
Look, I'm not an idiot. All right? I know it must have looked a little strange, you know, or whatever, with me here with some woman, close friend of mine, sees me. Even though it was innocent, I act as if it wasn't. So I say some stupid little...
Wanting to be wanted, or becoming the object of desire. While girls and women are actually discouraged in many ways in becoming self-determining and autonomous, they are encouraged by society and by mothers and by parents in general... to seek power through their appearance, and especially through being this kind of demeanor of being pretty nice and popular. Now, what's going on here? As I said earlier, Simone de Beauvoir said that when men set themselves up as subjects of their own desire, they needed some way to sort of relate to women, to make them... sort of fulfill the roles that the men wanted them to fulfill. So they offered a power to women, particularly to beautiful women, an opportunity to share in their power in being the subject of desire. So in offering women the possibility of wanting to be wanted, we're offering a way of finding power in an image rather than through actions. When we as women try to appear attractive, nice, good, valid, or worthy to someone else, instead of discovering what we actually feel and want about ourselves and want for ourselves, we are making a kind of conscious or unconscious arrangement. We are expecting other people to provide us with our feelings, our own feelings of self-confidence, worth, or vitality, at the expense of our own authentic development. And then we come to feel resentful, frustrated, and out of control when this does not happen. Because inevitably, other people cannot supply us with personal power when we have sacrificed our desires to unconscious arrangements that we've made with others. We find ourselves then always wanting to be seen in a positive light. The perfect mother, the ideal friend, the seductive lover, the slender or athletic body, the kind neighbor, the competent boss. In place of knowing the truth of who we are and what we want in our own lives, we become trapped in images. Now, wanting to be wanted is not codependency. It's not something that develops out of someone else's demands and needs. Rather, it comes from our own desires for power and control that have been transformed and hidden. Instead of learning how to become autonomous people, we learn gradually but clearly how to feel ashamed of our desires and or to make an appearance that seems pleasing. Now, the following scene that is also from Living Out Loud is a depiction of the emotional experience of wanting to be wanted, of what it feels like when, particularly in this scene, Holly Hunter is discovering, actually, what it's been like to give up her own authentic development and to take on an image. Now, in this scene, she has been divorced from her husband for a while, and the week before, she met a man at a bar, and she made an agreement, without actually knowing who he was or what his name was, to meet him at the bar the next week. And she showed up, and he didn't. So she's like five martinis into the evening, waiting for him there, and she's basically given up on the guy, and has now come into the ladies' room. You're going to see her in the ladies' room with Queen Latifah, who's the singer at the bar, who comes in to see if she's okay. And they have a little conversation about what it's like to live as an object of desire, which is what she's been doing. So just to give you the kind of emotional experience of this, and then I'm going to talk about it a little bit more after we see the scene.
What? What is the point of what you're doing?
Excuse me?
In here. Fixing your makeup. He's going to dump you eventually for someone younger, so what is the point? I mean, you're a nice-looking woman. Why does everything have to be about men?
You need some coffee.
You know, I once heard you sing, and I complimented you, and you completely ignored me.
Sorry. That was rude.
Yes, it was. But you're a terrific singer. Maybe people with talent are allowed to be rude. How come you only made one record?
Because nobody bought that.
I did.
Do you need some help getting home?
I'm fine. Don't you have to go back and do the amateur thing?
No. My boss cut it short tonight.
Sorry.
I don't mind. Although my boyfriend is waiting for me, so if you're going to be okay in here...
He's gay.
What?
Your friend.
You don't even know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. That young guy with the beautiful voice. I saw you looking at him when he sang. I saw your expression. I know that look.
I don't know how you can know that.
When you're laying in the gutter, you can see underneath people a little better than usual.
I'm going to go back to the other time.
Oh, I'm a native. I just clean up well. That's from living on the Upper East Side for 20 years. I learned how to let doormen carry my bags. I learned how to order wine and cater parties. Dump all my friends from home because their husbands didn't make as much as mine. And it was difficult to do things with them, things they couldn't afford. Good to admit that finally. Funny what you can tell a stranger and you can't tell people you know. I've told so many stories in my life. I'm so tired of telling you stories.
He left you?
I don't know who he left. I'm not sure where I've been for 20 years. I knew deep down he saw other women. I knew for years. I just kept thinking, he must know I know. That's why he stays. Because I let him do what he wants. Because I understand what he needs. And I don't make it difficult. He'll never leave. Why should he? He can do whatever he wants. as long as he stays. There are all kinds of marriages. At least I'm married. At least I'm safe. It's amazing, isn't it? The things you find yourself agreeing to.
I think that that scene gives a very good illustration of what it's like to live without the authenticity of your own experience. And, of course, in the movie, and we'll see a couple of more scenes, Holly Hunter actually comes to have the experience of living as the subject of her own life. But this experience of being the object of desire or wanting to be wanted, us directly at home or in the workplace without arousing suspicion, confusion, fear, and dread. As I said to somebody earlier tonight, women are often more willing to be seen in this negative light in the workplace, even though they don't enjoy it, but they don't want to be seen in this light at home. When you come home, you don't want to be seen as the bitch. You may be willing to take it in the workplace, but not at home. Both women and men still tend to experience female power as exotic at best and dangerous and despicable at worst. Lacking clear avenues, most girls and women unknowingly learn how to be indirect in taking control and making interpersonal arrangements that are supposedly based on others' needs and wants, but are actually based on their own needs and their own wanting to be wanted. We have been so thoroughly socialized and psychologically programmed to tune into the subtleties of whether or not we are having the desired effect that we may never know what we want or see how strongly we want to be wanted and understand what actual effects we might be having on our own and others' autonomy. After practicing depth psychotherapy for about 5 years, I've been practicing for 20, so it was about 15 years ago, I started to think about what I have come to call the little red hen complex, because I met it constantly in my consulting room, and I wondered if I specifically, I'll talk about this in case you don't know the story, if I specifically attracted this type of patient because I am myself a recovering little red hen. Now, you may or may not know the story. It's a child's nursery story, and the version that I'm going to tell of it, I'm going to tell you a little bit of the story, is the one that I read as a child, and it's actually been revised in the form that's out there now. So the little red hen, as I knew it, depicted the effects of a little bird who wants to be wanted. She does everything for those who live with her. Once upon a time, there was a little red hen who lived in a little house on the edge of a big woods. She could cook and she could sew and she swept and dusted the house every day. She had a garden where she planted corn and potatoes and peas and sunflowers. With the little red hen lived a cat and a rat and a mouse. The little red hen cooked their meals and took good care of them, but they were lazy and never did anything to help her. Now, over these 20 years of doing psychotherapy and analysis, it has been the case that more than half of my practice is composed of little red hens from all walks of life, from the convent to the corporation, from the university to the union. Now, if you know the story, in the end, in the version that I read, the little red hen is a hero. She outwits a dangerous fox and even manages to save the delicious cake that she baked for her lazy housemates. And when she returns home after her adventures, her companions are so glad to see her at home safely and so happy to have the cake back that they promise that they will never be selfish and lazy anymore. Right. Now, in real life, the red hens discover that no matter how hard they work to devote themselves to others' needs, the others only resent the control and feel bitter and spiteful, and they never keep their promises to reform. Now, I wish that the story had ended with that kind of teaching, because what we see in the little red hen is that the little red hen is interfering with the development of autonomy in those around her. Every time she asks the rhetorical question, who will go to the woodpile and fetch some wood to heat the oven to bake my beautiful cake? They each answer, I won't. So the little red hen says somewhat wearily, then I'll have to go and do it myself. And she does. Now, when I first read this story, and if you know the story, this happens many times in the beginning of the story. She asks, who will do this and who will do that? And, of course, the cat and the rat and the mouse always say, I won't. She always says, well, then I guess I'll have to do it myself. When I first read this story, knew about it, I had it read to me, but then I began to read it kind of obsessively myself when I was about 4 years old, because I knew that it was about my mother. And in fact, I was mesmerized by the story because it seemed to convey something that was unspeakable about her. And I believe now that it conveyed to me unconsciously how my mother had taken over the entire household with her hidden demands that were expressed in terms of what she was doing for the rest of us. And she was no different from other mothers in her generation and many mothers in this generation. She had no power in the world, and so she attempted to get her power from us. Now, I won't be able to talk about this in great depth, this issue of what I call hothouse mothering and the divine child, but it has to do with the problem of idealizing mothers and children and then isolating them, sort of breaking them off from the rest of society, so that mothers try to get their power through their children. And children then internalize the mother's power needs, and in various ways they reject that internalization. And for the daughter, this creates a special problem because she becomes in some way that which her mother wanted, what she wanted. Probably the most common thing that I see in doing psychotherapy, and of course most of the people I see as a Jungian are over the age of 35 and older, although I do see some younger people. But most commonly what I see people suffering from is the difficulty of having been closed up over a long period of time with a depressed and angry woman. That woman was their mother. And whether she expressed it openly or whether she withdrew and hid this, the effects have been very negative on the child, on the developing child. Now, of course, I see a special population. I see those people who come to psychotherapy. But I would say that most people who suffer from neurotic and to some extent narcissistic or other kinds of personality disorders suffer, at least in large part, from having been isolated with the emotional needs of a woman who was trapped in various ways and could not actualize herself. So, given that, I wish that the little red hen story had been told more honestly, because I think I wouldn't have pursued it as an outcome for myself. I was, and still tend to have to watch myself, particularly with my own children, the kind of person who would say, well, then I will do it if you're not going to do it. And not really making the decision to do it, but simply doing it because I thought it had to be done. So I want to show you a little clip of what actually happens to the little red hen, what it's like for her as she grows older in life. And again, remember, this is meant to be a comedy. The woman that's in this hospital bed could be my mother. She was very much like this woman. This is also from Living Out Loud. And in this scene, the Holly Hunter character is a practical nurse who's come to the home of this woman who's obviously dying and is being cared for by one of her daughters. And at the very end of the scene, you'll see a little reverie on the part of Holly Hunter where she thinks about a situation with her husband where she didn't actually make the decision but allowed a decision to be made for her. But mainly what I want you to see is how the little red hen at the end of life is struggling with all of the issues having to do with resentment, shame, and resentment.
Can't take this shit no
well,
more.
Then go.
I
my
have
life
it.
Is over. Go.
I got no life.
Don't do me
no life.
Mom,
did you hear
that
me?
I won't be much longer. I'll be dead soon.
Yeah, when? I want a date. I want to make reservations for Club Med.
You see how she talks to me? But bury me now. Don't wait. I'll die later. I don't want to waste anybody's time.
By the way, Judith, she don't want you here no more. She don't want a nurse. She don't want to go into a home. She just wants me to take care of her 24 hours a day and work. Oh, my God, them sisters sit on their big fat asses and do nothing.
They have their own lives.
See? See? Did you hear that? And I got nothing. I am so stressed.
Donna, go to work, please.
All right.
I raised three daughters. I had a no-good, worthless husband. Didn't give me one day of peace. Did I complain?
Every day of my fucking life.
You see that mouth? You hear that mouth? Oh, dear God, dear. You mind if I ask? You're divorced, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got any kind of wife? Any children?
No.
How long were you married?
16 years.
Oh, you couldn't get caught.
We didn't want any.
Sweetheart, I gotta be honest. Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm too selfish. Maybe I don't love kids enough. I know it sounds awful. I just don't want to. I'm sorry.
That's how you feel. It's not your fault. It's just, I mean, what are we going to do with all this space?
What, only people with kids can have country houses? Judith, listen to me. I love our life. I really do. We can do whatever we want. We have money. We can travel. Not everybody has to have kids to have a good life.
Okay. So, I told you that I was going to spend most of my time talking about the problem. So I'm finished talking about the problem right now. I'm going to talk about the solution a little bit. But before we leave the little red hen, I'd like to say a couple more words about her. She's not in the book. I hadn't actually thought of the little red hen story when I wrote the book, and it only occurred to me one day when I was sitting with a person that I see in analysis, and I see some people on the couch, and so I was sitting quietly, because I'm often not quiet otherwise, and realized that this woman was totally caught in being a little red hen. And so I made an interpretation along the lines of, sounds like the little red hen. She knew the story. And I began to think about how the little red hen story really epitomized the problem of wanting to be wanted and all of the dimensions of living with the shame and doubt and the resentment and so on. And then I started to empathize with the cat and the mouse and the rat and what it was like for them and why they never wanted to do what she wanted them to do. And anyway, a whole lot of things opened up as a result of that. But what I do want to mention is that it is very easy for a woman in the role of the little red hen to unknowingly infantilize the people around her, and especially her grown-up partner, whom she might see as a little boy, and then encourage to behave in ways that really aren't fully sort of respectable for an adult. And so that's another outgrowth of living as a little red hen. And tomorrow, when we talk about couples and we talk about the issues that couples deal with in terms of trying to form an egalitarian relationship, we will be talking to some extent about the projections of various sorts of things into one's partner And one of the projections of the little red hen is the projection of the little boy into the husband. So I will let it go at that and now talk a little bit about what it takes to become a subject of desire in your own life. And I'm going to tell a story, and it's the story of Gawain and the Lady Ragnell. And, of course, I first told this story in Hags and Heroes, which is a book that I wrote back in 1983. It was published in 84. And I was so amazed when I discovered this story, which dates back to 1250. It's a lesser-known story of the Knights of the Round Table. I discovered it when I was in college. And I could hardly believe at that time that this story was recorded in the Middle Ages, because in order for it to be recorded, it must have been told many times. And it has such radical meaning for the present time that it raises all sorts of issues that I've been talking about, and then that lead to a real reflection on what it means to have personal sovereignty in your own life. So one day, King Arthur was out hunting a great white stag at the edge of the oak woods when he looked up and found himself confronted by a tall, powerful chieftain swinging his sword and appearing as if he would cut the king down on the spot. This man was Sir Gromer, who declared that he was seeking revenge for the loss of some of his northern lands to Arthur. But since Arthur was unarmed, Sir Gromer showed the king mercy and gave him a chance to save his life. He issued a challenge. The king had 1 year to return unarmed to this spot with an answer to the question, "What do women desire above all else?" Now, if Arthur answered the question correctly, his life would be spared. If not, he would lose his head. Amazing that that question was so important back in the Middle Ages. Arthur agreed, but he was very discouraged. It must be a trick question, he thought, for he felt certain that no one knew the answer. Back at the castle, he told the entire story to his nephew, Sir Gawain, who was known as the wisest, the bravest, the most compassionate and courteous of all of the knights of the Round Table. And the young knight, in contrast to the king, was hopeful and encouraging. After all, they had a year to search the kingdom, and he was certain someone would know the answer. So Arthur and Gawain collected many answers throughout the months, but not one of them had the ring of truth. And as the appointed day grew near, Arthur was out one morning, riding alone through the fields, thinking about his predicament. At the edge of the oak woods, he was suddenly confronted with a large, grotesque woman who was covered with warts and almost as wide as she was tall. Her eyes met his fearlessly, and she declared, "You are Arthur the king. In 2 days, you must meet Sir Gromer with an answer to a question." "Yes," replied Arthur, "but how do you know this?" "I am the Lady Ragnell, and Sir Gromer is my stepbrother. You do not have the right answer, do you?" "Well, I have many answers, and I don't see how my business concerns you." "You do not have the right answer," she said with a confidence that filled the king with gloom. "I have the answer." Arthur turned and leaped off his horse. "Tell me the answer then, and I'll give you a large bag of gold." "I have no use for gold." "Nonsense, woman, you can buy anything you want with it." "What do you want then? Jewelry? Land? Whatever you want, I will pay you. That is, if you have the right answer." "I have the answer. I can promise you that." And after a slight pause, she added, "I ask in return that Sir Gawain become my husband." Arthur gasped. "It's impossible. You ask the impossible, woman. I cannot give you my nephew. He's his own man, not mine to give." "I did not ask you to give me the knight Gawain. If Gawain agrees to marry me of his own free will, then I will give you the answer to the question. Those are my terms." "Terms? What right do you have to give me terms? and it's impossible. I would never bring him that proposal. Ragnell stared into Arthur's eyes and said simply, "If you should change your mind, I will be here tomorrow." Then she disappeared into the woods. Shaken from this strange encounter, Arthur rode home at a slow pace, thinking to himself that he could never speak to Gawain of this matter. The loathsome woman! How dare she ask for the finest knight in marriage? But the afternoon air was soft, and the fateful meeting with Gromer weighed heavily on Arthur. So when the king returned to the castle, he found himself telling his nephew about his adventure, concluding, "She knows the answer, I'm sure of it, but, well, I really didn't intend to tell you all of this." But Gawain smiled sweetly, not yet knowing Ragnell's specific proposal, and said, "This is good news, uncle. Why do you sound so discouraged?" So with his eyes averted, the king told Gawain Ragnell's proposal, accompanied by a detailed description of her appearance. "How fortunate that I can save your life," said Gawain immediately. And over his uncle's protests, he stated, "It is my choice and my decision. I will return with you tomorrow and agree to the marriage on the condition that her answer saves your life." Early the next morning, Gawain rode out with Arthur to meet the Lady Ragnell. Even seeing her face to face did not shake his resolve. Her proposal was accepted, and Gawain bowed to her courteously. "If tomorrow your answer saves the king's life, we shall be wed." On the fateful morning, Gawain rode out part of the way with Arthur, who assured the knight that he would try all of the other answers first. The tall, powerful Gromer was waiting for Arthur, his broadsword gleaming in the sun. As Arthur read out one answer after another, Gromer shouted, "No, no, no," until at last he raised his sword high above his head. "Wait," the king cried, "I have one more answer. What a woman desires above all else is the power of sovereignty, the right to exercise her own free will." With a loud oath, Gromer dropped his sword to his side. "You didn't find that answer on your own. My cursed stepsister Ragnell gave it to you. I'll cut off her head, I'll run her through with my sword," and he turned away and plunged into the woods, a string of curses echoing after him. Arthur returned to where Gawain waited with the Lady Ragnell, and all three rode back to the castle in silence. Only Ragnell seemed in good spirits. The news spread quickly throughout the castle that a bizarre wedding was to take place between an ugly hag and the magnificent Gawain. No one could imagine what had persuaded Gawain to marry this creature. Some thought she must possess great lands and estates. Others thought she must have secret magic. But most were just stunned at the fate of poor Gawain. Even Arthur drew his nephew aside. A postponement might be in order. "But I gave her my word, uncle. Would you have me break my word?" And so the wedding took place in the abbey, and the strange wedding feast was held before the entire court. Throughout the long day and evening, Gawain remained pleasant and courteous. In no way did he show anything but kind attention to his bride. At last, the wedding couple retired to their chamber. "You have kept your promise well and faithfully," Ragnell observed. "You've shown me neither pity nor revulsion. So, come kiss me now. We are wedded." Gawain went to her at once and kissed her. When he stepped aside, before him stood a serene, beautiful woman with gray eyes and a smiling face. His scalp tingled with shock, and he jumped back. "What manner of sorcery is this?" Ragnell replied, "Do you prefer me in this form?" as she turned slowly in a full circle. "Yes, of course, but I don't understand," said Gawain, who was confused and frightened. "My stepbrother Gromer has always hated me. He obtained a knowledge of sorcery from his mother and used it to change me into a monstrous hag. He commanded me to live in that shape until the finest knight in Britain, willingly chose me as his bride. But why did he hate you so cruelly? Asked Gawain. With her lips curled in amusement, Ragnell observed, he thought me bold and unwomanly, because I refused his commands both for my property and my person. With great admiration, Gawain said, then you have won the impossible condition, and his evil spell is broken. Only in part, my dear Gawain. You have a choice which way I will be. Would you have me in this, my own shape at night in our chamber? Or would you have me grotesque in our chamber at night, and my own shape by day in the castle? Fair by night or fair by day, think carefully before you choose. Gawain knelt before his bride, and he responded at once, it is a choice I cannot make. It concerns you, my dear Ragnell, and only you can choose. Whatever you choose, I will willingly abide by it. Ragnell released a long, deep breath, and the radiance in her face overwhelmed him. You have answered well, dearest Gawain. Your answer has broken Gromer's evil spell completely. The last condition he set was that after marriage, the greatest knight in Britain must give me the power of sovereignty, the right to exercise my own free will. And only then would the wicked enchantment be broken forever. And so, in wonder and in joy, began the marriage of Sir Gawain and the Lady Ragnell. Now, I must tell you that I read the extant version of this story in Middle English, and there is a little amendment at the end that they split up after 5 years. And it's really there. So, you know, an egalitarian marriage is not easy. But in any case, the spell was broken for Ragnell. Now, this ancient story holds dimensions of meaning that are much deeper than its entertaining surface. It's a tale not only about self-determination and self-confidence in women, but also about the confinement of a traditional patriarchal marriage, which, when the story was set down in written text, required by law that a woman surrender her freedom and her property to her husband. Indeed, I am certain that this tale was told as a warning to women and men about the psychological and interpersonal dangers of a condition that eliminated a woman's personal sovereignty. In the medieval period when the tale originated, the power of the mythical hag to rob people of their vitality was well known to audiences. So audiences listening to this story would know that the hag as a character was known to ride the bodies of men and children at night while they were sleeping, absorbing their vigor into herself. And in the morning, her poor victims would wake to a kind of lifeless gloom. The kiss of the hag was her most potent weapon. Getting close to her lips meant risking having your soul sucked out. So she was well known as a character, like we all sort of recognize Woody Allen as a character and know certain things and expect certain things of him. The audience would have known that as a hag, she was dangerous because of this soul-sucking potential, this devitalizing potential of the hag. A medieval audience would have appreciated Gawain's courage in kissing his bride so directly. They would have guessed that he performed this act without hesitation, because he sensed Ragnell's true nature, that he saw beyond her appearance and trusted that she was not really a destructive hag who would exhaust and dominate him. Now today, when women want to be wanted, they unintentionally reinforce the misogynist belief that a demanding woman is to be dreaded and subdued. When we act as though our desires are too much and can overtake another's free will or good sense, then we reinvent negative hag psychology, and we are at risk for identifying ourselves and our desires with an alien, almost superhuman emotional power. It is only when we speak directly with a secure self-confidence that we step outside of this negative meaning of female desire. Recognizing our desires as human-sized rather than monstrous means that we can speak about them directly. I see this come up very often, and Ragnell's a very good example of what to do about it, and so is this film clip that I'm going to show in a few minutes. In a situation where a woman is in an uncommitted relationship, in Vermont we have a lot of people living in uncommitted relationships. I don't know if it's true out here, but we seem to, one thing that I come up against there that seems really quite different from Philadelphia, where I was for 15 years, is that people will live in long, long relationships and not commit themselves to each other, which arouses a lot of separation anxiety. Everybody gets pretty nasty eventually. And women very often will know that they want a commitment, but they're afraid to say it. And when I ask them, why are you afraid to say it, typically I get the answer, I want him to choose for himself. But that's a little confusing. How, you know, if you said directly, I would like a committed relationship, or I will leave if you don't actually commit yourself to me, the other person's still free to choose. You know, there's no monstrous sort of power in one's statement of wanting something directly. So Ragnell shows us that when you speak clearly, that you are not, you're speaking in a human way then, not as a monster. Although she was doomed to be the loathsome lady, Ragnell knew that her needs and desires were acceptable. She knew that Gawain had to make the choice himself, and that neither she nor Arthur controlled him. She did not apologize for herself, nor did she blame others. She simply spoke directly from her heart. The story of Ragnell symbolizes the development of a woman's personal sovereignty within the confines of a patriarchal society. Ragnell must depend on men in power to assist her in becoming a free agent in her own life, but that is not so different from our situation today. At no point is Ragnell passive, compliant, or indirect. She defies her stepbrother. She finds a way to break his spell. She even confronts the king, telling him that he does not know what a woman desires. She watches her new husband carefully, and she skillfully presents a challenge to him, "Kiss me," at the moment when it's most likely to be effective. And ultimately, she is aware that she cannot become self-determining without relying on others. She poses her questions to Gawain in order to test him to see if he has grasped this fundamental condition of her life. Not until Gawain kneels before her and answers well do we fully understand that Ragnell has been transformed not by his kiss, but by the process of her own courage in pursuing her freedom. And so Ragnell shows us by example how to resist identifying with the hag complex. First, she keeps her own counsel in the face of a challenge. Although by all standards she is ugly, she remains unconcerned about her appearance. She speaks from her own knowledge and authority. She feels free to arrange her life according to her desires, even though there may be retaliations. She is aware of the crucial importance of personal sovereignty, and she will not be dissuaded by spells, insults, or rejections. She will not have her motives demeaned, even by the king. Now, to understand why, many hundreds of years later, women still struggle to follow her lead, we need to look more closely at the curse of the hag and its alternative of the muse complex. I haven't actually mentioned the muse, but it's just the term that I use in relation to the hag. I use the muse to represent the object of desire. The move to shame female desire by turning it into the image of a dreaded hag bitch is matched by a counter move to elevate female beauty and grace into positions of power. If female desire is stifled, then how can women be attracted to fill their designated roles as wives, lovers, workers, and mothers? They are promised other means of attaining power, means that remain under male control. The muse is not her own person. She is always under the control of the master. Let me say one or two things about the muse, and you know this just from knowing stories of the muse. The muse actually vitalizes. She inspires, and she has to do with creativity and procreation. The muse fills the master with life and vitality. The hag devitalizes, and she sucks out vitality, and she empties the master of his life. So these two images, the muse and the hag, actually have been posed in patriarchal society to have opposite effects. One, the devitalizing hag, the other, the vitalizing muse. Now, if you had a choice, what would you choose? You know, you would not really want to be the devitalizing hag. So the muse is not her own person. She is always under the control of the master. He is the subject, and she is the object of desire. A woman who identifies with being the muse can never be known for who she is. As the story illustrates, if she defies the rules and becomes too much, as Monica Lewinsky is a very good illustration of for the entire world, she is transformed into the slut or the bitch. So the muse who wants too much for herself will be transformed into the bitch. So even a woman coming in wanting to be the object of desire, if she becomes the subject, she'll be transformed. Being the object of desire precludes autonomy and self-determination for a woman. On the other hand, being the subject of your own desires does not preclude having an attractive appearance or a pleasant manner, as Ragnell shows at the end of the story when she has these herself. And yet, appearance, manners, niceness, and image are not the central motivators for a woman who is the subject of her own desires. Because she wants to be known for who she is instead of how she looks, she is straightforward and direct. Now, I'm going to show a couple of examples from film clips, and then I think what we'll do is take about a 10-minute break. Come back, I'll make a few concluding remarks about the paradox of autonomy, and then take questions and discussion. So these two clips, one is from Living Out Loud, and it's Holly Hunter with Danny DeVito, and in this scene, Holly Hunter has just come downstairs to visit her building manager, her friend, Danny DeVito. And they've already become friends, and the scene has to do with Holly Hunter's desire to tell him what she's really experiencing and not just go along with what he's saying to her. And so it's an example of a woman speaking as the subject of her own desires. The other scene is from a movie called The Fisher King, which you may know of, and it's a scene with Jeff Bridges, who is the protagonist in the movie, and Mercedes Ruehl, who plays opposite Jeff Bridges. And the situation here is Jeff Bridges is a very narcissistic radio talk show host who has caused a great difficulty in New York City where he hosts a show. He has unknowingly advocated a situation where some people were murdered. And as a result of that, when he realizes that he has caused this through some things he said on his show, he has a psychological break. And Mercedes Ruehl finds him kind of in the streets. And she takes him into her house and she refurbishes him. She feeds him. She gives him a job. She kind of she gets involved with him. She loves him. And now he's feeling much better. And so what he's going to tell her in this scene is that he needs some space. Now that he's feeling better, what he needs is a little time to figure out what he's doing in his life. And it's been about a year that they've been in what she thinks is a relationship. So she actually does what I'm always hoping that women will do, which is that when he says, "I just need some time here for myself," she says, "If you want to get out of this, get out. Don't do something so that you get to leave being the nice guy." And so she speaks very directly. Now, both of these scenes are examples that I wish had a little bit less of one thing and a little more of the other. They're imperfect examples. They're not as good as Ragnell, actually. But it's really hard to find scenes in movies where women are speaking directly and they come off in a way that they're not just being demeaned as the hag bitch. So these scenes are imperfect, but they're both good examples of women claiming their authentic position and being energized from that, even though neither of these women actually is getting her way. So these two scenes, then we'll take a break for 10 minutes if you... Wait, there are refreshments here, is that right? So actually we should say 15 minutes because there are refreshments. And so whenever it ends, come back in 15 minutes. I'll make some concluding remarks and then we'll have some discussion.
Rocked before. I'm sorry.
Need some coffee? Yeah. There's something that I want to get off my chest. It's been bugging me. It's about the first night that we talked, the night that I borrowed the money.
Oh, no. You don't have to.
No, I want to. Won't come clean with us.
I'm not needing the money for the gas guy.
You knew?
$189 gas bill for 5th Avenue Co-op.
Why'd you give it me?
I don't know. I figured you were good for it.
There's something else that I wanted to ask you. I was wondering if one night... This is tough. I'm really, really rusty at this.
Pat, don't.
What?
Don't. I don't want to hurt your feelings.
Hurt my feelings about what?
I think I know what you're going to ask.
You do?
And I'd rather you didn't.
See, I just wanted to know if you wanted to have dinner with me sometime. Maybe go out to the movie or something.
I'm just asking you not to ask me.
You were right. Well, I thought maybe you could have been completely off the mark.
You?
So you knew what I was... Like, is that a no?
Look, I think you're a wonderful person, but I think that...
But I like you.
Yes. And I think I know what you want.
Yeah. So? I think you're a terrific person, too. I like being with you. I'd like to, you know, see you more, take you out, spend some time with you.
But that's not possible.
Why? Because of what I do?
No.
Are you sure?
Look, you're not being honest. It's not just about spending time with me.
You feel comfortable with me, right? When we have a good time and we're talking, nice time. Kind of jokes or kidding around, right?
Yes, but I don't want you thinking it can be anything more than that.
Well, it's none of your business what I think or what I want. You can't control that.
Well, it just won't happen.
How do you know?
I know.
How can you know? You can't know a thing like that.
I'm not attracted to you that way.
So maybe it'll change.
It won't.
How do you know that?
I know. I want to feel my life. I want to be authentic. I want to stop agreeing to things I don't really want.
Then stop. Look, Judith, I'm not asking you to marry me. I'm just saying let's spend a little time together. Whatever happens, doesn't happen, it doesn't matter.
Of course it's going to matter. If you want to sleep with me and I don't, it's going to matter.
No, believe me, it won't matter.
So if I want to just be friends, that's what we'll be?
Yes. Unless it changes. Well, you never know. How can you know? You don't know. Things change. I might lose interest. I mean, it's not a great possibility that I might lose interest. We're laughing here. We're having a good time.
I don't want this.
Then why'd you come down here?
To apologize.
Oh, you came down here to apologize. Is that it? Is that authentically why you came down here?
No. I came down here because I can't sleep. And because I don't want to be alone. Tell him he's going to be here. Are you coming? Come in. I would love to look for a bigger place. I mean, I'm not enough for anything. But I'd like to start looking anyway, you know? Maybe a two-bedroom? Or maybe even top floor of a house? Say in Brooklyn? Heights?
What? You don't want to commute, right?
Come here.
You are an incredible woman.
I'm an incredible woman?
Yeah.
What, is this a death sentence?
No, I'm not going to talk about this. So much has happened that it would be a good thing for both of us if we slowed down a little.
Slowed down? Where have I been? Have we been going faster?
Come on here. Well, this has been a real, real difficult time for me this past year or so.
Okay.
And, I feel like I'm above water for the first time. I feel like I know a lot more now, and I don't want to make any more mistakes.
So?
I think I need time to make the right choices to,
Wait. I'm lost here. What
are
you saying?
Maybe I should be alone for a while. Now that, I know more, I feel like I should focus on my career now that I can, now that everything's taken care of. You know, Perry's...
All right, first of all, let me just say one thing, okay? You don't know shit, okay? Secondly, as far as we go, what have we been doing here except Tom? Have I ever pressured you once, ever? No. So what time do you need, baby? I love you. You love me. You want to get your career going? I think that's the greatest thing in the world. I want to be there when I'm sorry. I want to be there when it happens. So what do you need time to figure out, huh? All right, let me just ask you one thing. You love me?
I don't know.
You can't even give me that, can you?
Jesus, Jack. What were you planning on doing? Were you planning on just packing up your things, walking out the door, and dropping me a note when you need...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.